We are in Galatians chapter 6, and we're looking at the application of all of this book in terms of learning how to relate to God by grace so that His Spirit can produce the life of Jesus through us so that Galatians 2:20 actually works. We are in chapter 6, and we're going to look at verse 3 because it's one of Paul's issues of dealing with people who are pretty legalistic in their thinking. He says, if anyone thinks he's something when he's nothing, he deceives himself. And that's pretty confrontational. But it's obvious that he's doing that because of verses 1 and 2, where he is insisting that if you're going to attempt to restore a brother who's overtaken by a sin, you have to have your own self squared away, that you're walking by the power of the Spirit. That's ye who are spiritual. And there's a whole big, huge difference between being spiritual and thinking you are. So that's where verse 3 comes into play, because the whole idea is if a person is going to take on the responsibility of trying to help somebody else in their spiritual life, they better have their own attitude about themselves squared away. Because if they think they're something, being nothing, they're just self-deceived. And of course, that'll mean they won't be able to do it. It's interesting, we were listening just briefly to Christian radio yesterday on our way over here, and this girl was singing this song, and in the song it says, you can't love others until you love yourself. And I thought, golly, it's just pervasive, you know, this goofball stuff comes out. And anyway, just thought that'd be, that's free. Just put that in extra. Paul is dealing in chapter 6 with relating to somebody else who's having serious trouble. The nature of the trouble in verse 1 is that he's been overtaken. The issue of being tested or tempted by something and then crashing and burning, because I don't care what it is you believe, it will be tested. And when your faith is not well-founded, when it's tested, there's always a problem that comes up, because faith is tested for a reason, both from a demonic as well as a divine perspective. The demons want you to fail in your faith, because that's how they cut you loose from the Spirit of God, so that you're not one of His instruments for the benefit of others. Because the Spirit of God uses our bodies to minister to other people, and if they can break the faith link, they'll break that whole cycle. So that's what they're doing. But God, on the other hand, allows our faith to be tested, because He knows that if you don't exercise a muscle, it'll atrophy and die. I mean, it's got to be subjected to the stresses that cause it to grow. That's the way it works. So there's a good and a bad side to this whole thing. But in verse 1, obviously, the brother has professed a faith that, in particular given area, that didn't hold up when he was hit with the alternative. Bang, he lost it. And so the ones who are spiritual are supposed to come to that person and try to work things out. And they have to do it in the spirit of meekness, looking to themselves, lest they also be tempted. They're to bear one another's burdens, like we were talking about last night, and really fulfill the essence of what Christianity is, this idea of being willing to be used by God for the benefit of somebody else, no matter what the personal cost, because that's the law of Christ. That's the principle that the kingdom of the Christ has at its bottom foundation, being willing to sacrifice for others because you love them. And so verse 3 just kind of comes in here from this problem area of attempting to restore somebody when you're not right yourself. And of course, that's a huge problem, because of the fact that the Jews in Jesus' day put him to death because they thought he was wrong and they were right. So it's not hard to think that you're fine. It's this other person that needs to be corrected. So he comes in here with this, if anyone thinks he's something when he's nothing, he deceives himself. So what we're going to do this morning is look at this issue of the corollary to the law of the Christ, and that is the law of reality, in relation to how we think about ourselves. And what does he mean, if you think you're something being nothing? Because there's a huge issue here in the idea that we're nothing. Because Christ wouldn't have died for people who were nothings. That's the problem, Mary. We've got to be of some highly significant value to God, or He would have not sacrificed His Son for our sake. And if we're that valuable to Him, then obviously we're something in His eyes. So what we have to understand is what Paul was actually saying here. And so that's kind of where we're going. Paul says in verse 3 at the end that there's this issue of self-deception that's involved. If you're not thinking properly about yourself, then the reason is because of this self-deception. And the word that Paul used that's translated deceives himself is a really rare word. Liddell Scott is that dictionary of the Greek New Testament, or of the Greek language. It covers all of the known Greek manuscripts of secular as well as religious literature. It's about this thick, and it's a big book. It's supposed to be an exhaustive dictionary. Every use of every word in the Greek language that's ever been found up until they published this is supposed to be referenced in there. So when you look at a word in there, if you see, you know, 3 or 4 paragraphs, it's not unusual. This is what words are used a lot. But this word, translated deceives himself, gets 2 lines in this dictionary. 2 lines. And it's set up in 4 columns across 2 pages, so it's each column is half, and its print is really small. But if you get 2 lines, that's all you get on this word. So he's obviously not using a word that people are real familiar with, that was used a lot. And so you have to ask yourself, why would he do this? Why would he choose a word that's way out here in terms of usefulness? And start from there. What do you mean, Paul, that we're deceiving ourselves if we're not thinking properly about ourselves? Well, the word is actually a combination word. We coin words in English to suit a need for a particular setting, and that's the way all words were formed. All words were coined in order to accomplish, to meet a particular need. And we've seen these vocabulary things. Every time there's a new... Well, for example, the computer age has generated enormous vocabulary where we took words that were familiar and then we applied them specifically to a totally new realm. For example, a hard drive. That's driving from Lake Charles to Georgetown. That's a hard drive. But it's not a hard drive when you're talking about your computer. So, you know, this is the way language works. So when you have a combination word, you know that Paul is putting words together to form an idea. And the common word that's at the bottom of this combination is a word that just means a significant level of deceit. That means that in order to see it, you have to have a fairly highly developed line of discernment. You have to be able to say, okay, I see what's going on here because this deception is very profound, but here's the problem. And that means you have this level of discernment that says that you can take on this very difficult deception and expose it. And that's the word he uses for the first part, or the foundation for his combination word, is that there's going to be a significantly profound level of deception here. And of course, you can see that illustrated in the Pharisees' attitudes in the New Testament. They were absolutely convinced they were right, and they were dead wrong. This is Paul on the road to Damascus. On the road down, he's going to go persecute, prosecute, kill if he can anybody that believes in the way. And he's just dead sure he's right. Just absolutely dead sure. And all of a sudden, the Shekinah glory surrounds him, and he hears this voice from heaven, and his whole theological construct just crumbles like a bunch of shattered tempered glass. Just because he's confronted by the truth, and the truth is so far opposite to what he thought it was, that there's nothing left of his construct theologically. It just shatters.
So he goes off into Arabia for a while to get his head back together. And the Holy Spirit's the one who makes it possible for us to get this kind of thing to happen. So we have this issue of deceit, but it's wedded in to the typical word for the brain as the tool up here in our skull of the mind. The mind and the brain are not the same thing. But the brain is the physical instrument. The mind is what uses the brain in order to be able to form thoughts and so on. So when you have your mind using your brain, what you have is data coming in through your five senses, all going into the brain, and then you, as a mental reality, sit over this data, and you make choices about where this data fits. This goes here, this goes here, this goes. We call that connecting the dots. Or, using another figure, it's like taking a puzzle with 2,500 pieces, and you keep looking at all of the little different nuances and how these form. And then you put the ones together that fit. That's how you think. That's how thoughts are organized in your brain. That's why even little kids, they are forever doing this at a very fundamental level. That's why they stick stuff in their mouth. They're trying to get some sensory input so they can make some connections. That's why they're always exploring. They're doing things with all five of their senses trying to make sense of their universe, as small as it is. And over time, that's how everybody learns. So, when Paul combines this idea of brain deception here, you are deceived at a very fundamental level. Your mind has been completely messed up in terms of the data that's in your brain so that you cannot think straight. The process of sifting this mass of data and putting the pieces together is what we call reason. We logically think. We say this logically is connected to this. And logic's the only way anybody can think. If you get logic out of the thought process, you have no thought process because there's no way to connect things. But logic is the way you connect. 2 + 2 = 4 is a logical progression. So the logical places in our brains, the data is shifted by our minds to the various places where they fit. And the only time we really have a problem is when we try to make it fit and it won't. We think, well, it's got to fit, and it won't. It's kind of like taking this piece of puzzle and this piece and forcing it. But it won't force because they're not set up quite right. The best illustration of this that I can think of in theology is the law of Moses. Everybody, divorced from a proper understanding of the law of Moses, thinks that God gave the law to tell people how to behave. I mean, it's just as logical as it could be, except it's dead wrong. He did not give the law to tell us how to behave. He knows that we cannot behave. He wouldn't do something that irrational. So Paul says, on the basis of that irrationality, that the law wasn't given to make people behave. It was given to reveal their sin to them so that they could see how badly off they were. And the whole point is that becomes a schoolmaster to force you to look for a different solution to the problem of your alienation with God. As long as you think you can behave, that's the way to relate. Behave. But if you ever realize you can't behave, and you realize if you don't behave, you're going to perish, and you think, well, maybe God's merciful in providing another way, then you're open to the gospel. Because the gospel says, since you couldn't behave, Jesus came and did behave, and he'll give you the outcome of his performance in exchange for your sin, if you'll just believe me. So that's the whole rationality issue. And it's interesting that in the two lines that Liddell Scott give to this particular combination word, indicates that people who are at this level of brain deception are stark raving mad. That's what Liddell Scott said. They're just crazy. The problem with being crazy, since the level is a level of extreme deceit, so that we're not just talking about being slightly misled here. We're talking about extreme deceit. The extreme deceit is deceit that's buried below an enormous mass of data. You ever wonder why evolutionists are evolutionists? It's not because it's rational, it's because it's buried under all this data. Somebody has come along and said, this will answer all the problems of the data. And they bought that without ever testing it. And then after they bought it, well, then they see how all the data seems to fit. So then they become convinced that this is how it fits. And it's not. It's a lie. So this is where this idea of man thinking he is something when he's nothing comes into play, because that's part of the data that's involved in this extraordinary level of deceit. And the problem with people that are stark raving mad is that thinking of yourself as something when you're nothing is reduced by Paul's word to being stark raving mad. You're nuts if you think you're something being nothing. You're nuts. Well, the problem with that is that there are more people who are nuts than they're not. The vast majority of humanity is stark raving mad, because they think they're something when they're nothing. And when the majority think they're right, who did they say is stark raving mad? The people who got it right. The majority rules here. Hey, if you think this and the rest of us think that, guess who's wrong? Guess who's crazy? Guess who needs to go into some kind of re-educational system, who needs some kind of psychotic drugs to get their mind back on track. It's not the person who knows the truth. It's the person who is the minor element in a large group. So given the fact that the world is filled with people who are completely wrong, obviously they're going to think we are, because we're telling them they are. Well, this is where Paul is on this. The vast majority of humanity has become stark raving mad, and it's the sane who are regarded as mad. And Paul probably had that in mind when he used this very rare word, because he wanted, when somebody throws a word at you that you're not familiar with, they're clearly trying to get you to think. Especially if they know you're not familiar with the word. So Paul is trying to get the Galatians to hesitate over this issue of thinking about themselves. Because the most natural desire in the human psyche, in terms of what I think about myself, the most natural desire is to think well of myself. Everybody wants to be able to think well of themselves. In fact, when are we the most wounded? When somebody shoots us in the leg with a bullet, or somebody makes a snide, nasty remark about who we are. The one you can fix with some stitches and medication. The other one just festers and festers and festers. Because we don't like to be insulted. We do not like people to think badly of us. We don't want to be reduced to nothing in people's eyes. Well, that's fundamentally pride of life stuff. That's one third of the whole ballgame. So almost no one lives in this present world thinking that they're nothing. Almost everybody thinks more highly of themselves than they ought to think. So the issue then is that there's a major problem, and it seems to be the idea that God would have sent the Christ only if people were significantly something. Because why would he send Christ to die for nothings, for people that are nothing? And our reason says, well, he wouldn't have done that. But Paul is not even hesitant to say, if you think you're something being nothing, you're stark raving crazy. So that means that we need to understand what he's really talking about here. Is he really saying that does nothingness mean valueless? Well, it does. It does in the vast majority of humanity. Because if you are nothing, you can do nothing. If you can do nothing, you're worthless. That's just the way it is. If you're nothing, you can't do anything, that means you're worthless. Well, that's only true in a works philosophy. In a legal theology, the only people who are worthless are those who won't obey. And, of course, the whole concept of being cast into the lake of fire is a concept of saying you're ultimately, finally worthless. God will not cast anybody into the lake of fire that hasn't become totally worthless to him in terms of any good purpose in his kingdom, other than the good that he works out of it. So the ultimate insult to anybody is to say, you're so worthless that this is where you're going. That's the ultimate insult. But he's obviously going to do that to a whole lot of people, so that means they are worthless. But based on what? Is it because they are nothing and can do nothing? Or is their worthlessness created by the fact that they are nothing but think they are something? Because when you think you're something, then you do stuff. But what's the stuff that's being done coming from? A deluded brain. You're crazy, so you're doing crazy things. That does kind of make you worthless. So Paul is pretty blunt in saying man is nothing, but you have to understand the context because it's limited. Paul is not saying in his description of reality that man is nothing across the board. He's got a limited context here. He has a profoundly deep context for the statement, and that is this book, which is all about the conflict between law and promise. There are two huge issues with law and promise, because law and promise are considered the methodologies, the optional methodologies for man being able to relate to God. You either relate to God by obeying the laws, or you relate to him by believing his promises. You cannot mix them. It's either or. The methodologies are mutually exclusive. If law is the methodology, then you relate to God by obedience. If promise is the methodology, you relate to God by faith. Those are really big deals. They're as deep as you can consider. But they're rooted in some very, very, very basic truth. And the truth that they're rooted in is, number one, ever since Adam's sin in the garden, Genesis 3, law has been deadly for human beings. In fact, you could even make the argument that it was deadly before, because that's what killed them. Don't eat that. That's what killed them. Not in the sense that at that time they didn't have the ability to obey, because they did. They were morally neutral, I guess you'd have to say they were morally neutral, because they actually had the ability to either do or not do. Since Adam sinned and he plunged his whole offspring into that sin issue, from that point on, men have not had the ability to do what's right. They have not had it. They're absolutely incapable of doing anything right. Paul said that. There's not one good. There's none that does good, not even one. Well, that means then that law as a methodology for relating to God is a methodology for being estranged from God forever. You'll never relate to him in a positive way by law. Can't be done. Promise, on the other hand, is man's only hope. Because promise begins with a premise. And that premise is that the one who makes the promise is obligated to keep it. That takes all the burden off the person to whom the promise was made if he yields to it as an issue of faith. When I trust God, I am responsible to do nothing. He's the one who made the promise. If I trust him, he's got to come across with it. Now, that doesn't mean my body will be inert and my body won't be involved in the issue, but the fact is God didn't give his spirit to dwell in our bodies because we were capable. He gave us his spirit to dwell in our bodies because we weren't capable, but he wanted to use our bodies to accomplish his purposes in this world, and so he gave us his spirit to do that. And that means his spirit will do through my body what he wants to be done if I will trust him, because that's his promise. So under promise, the burden's on him. If I believe him, he has to do it. Now, if I don't trust him, he's not obligated to do a thing. But the point is, in God's universe, which is fundamentally relational and then secondarily mechanical. The mechanical universe serves the relational universe. God created a relational universe so that people could relate. He created a physical universe so that dumb people could relate. He had to have a tool to teach us. You can't communicate omniscience to finitude except piecemeal. And that means you got to have some stuff line upon line, precept upon precept. And in the process of the line upon line, precept upon precept, something's going to come winging in here that this poor person does not understand. And that's something that comes in as a test or temptation. And at that point, it comes in there and they don't understand it. They're liable to say and do something against God because they don't understand. And that's the problem. God can't communicate omniscience to finitude. He's got to do it piecemeal. So there's always this danger, because piecemeal believers believe what they believe, but they don't believe what they don't understand. And it's the lack of understanding that causes the problem. So when we talk about a relational universe, we're talking about God's promise is relational harmony. He's going to make it work. He's going to make it possible for us to relate to Him. Well, that's His promise. And all He asks us to do is believing. But believing is not simple in the sense that believing God means that you take a stand on this. This is what I believe. And when something comes along and challenges it, you hang on to this thing that you know is true because you believe it. You know it's true. That's why you believe it. This looks like it's going to contradict it. Well, appearances are deceiving. So you hang on to what you know is true, that you've already believed, until this gets clear. That's the whole process. Now, God's the one who makes it work. That's the whole point. He made the promise. He'd make it work. All we got to do is depend on Him. So, given that backdrop, the statement, if anyone thinks he's something when he's nothing, he is stark raving mad, that means that this statement is directly tied to the underlying principle of these two systems. And the underlying principle of the two system is that man is incapable of doing good in order to relate. Relationships can't be built off of you owe me because I did this for you kind of stuff. Can't call in your markers. Relationships are rooted in love and forgiveness, so that when the person fails, the failure is not unanticipated. Didn't you know they'll always fail you at some point? So you forgive because you love them. Well, that's a relational reality. That's not a legal one. So, given that, what's going on then is that Paul sees no contradiction between his statement that man is nothing and his claim that God loves men, as is revealed by the crucifixion of the Son of God. God would not have let Christ be crucified if men were really nothing in the sense of being valueless. But like we said, valueless based on nothingness is a legal issue. If you are nothing, you can do nothing. And if you can do nothing, you're worthless. That's legal. Being nothing, meaning you can't do anything right, does not mean you're not valuable to God under a relational universe. That's the whole point. God saw us as incapable, but He loved us. We were valuable to Him. We were very valuable. But it wasn't based on what we could do for Him. So, when we didn't do what He wanted us to do, He didn't say, you're valueless. He didn't say that. He sent His Son to die so that He could remedy the relational breakdown based on what? Man thinking he's something when he's nothing. What does that mean? He thinks he can do stuff when he can't do stuff. If you think you can do this when you can't do it, you're nuts. That's what Paul is saying. He's not saying that we're nothing in an absolute sense. He's saying it in terms of a particular context. And the particular context is the context of people who cling to somethingness in respect to their ability. That's what verses 1, 2, and 3 are all about. If you think that you can go and correct a brother and restore him from his fall, If you think you can do that, guess what? You're going to mess things up big time. Because without your awareness that you have no capacity to do that, you will not depend on the Spirit to do it. And if you're not depending on the Spirit to do it, guess what comes across to the person that you're trying to restore? A smug kind of superiority. You wouldn't catch me doing that. Well, you suppose anybody's going to respond to that? Not likely. This is as simple as breathing, in the sense that what Paul is saying is, if you think you can do something when you can't, you're just crazy. And the only person who says, well, I'm not crazy, well, is the person who clings to this idea that I can do something to make myself valuable to God. I can do it. And if you cling to that, you're only going to be finally proven to be wrong. What people are actually insisting on is that the love of God be performance evaluated. God will love me if I do certain things a certain way. And when you tie love to that, it's not love anymore. Because you know what that means? I'll only love you if you do what I tell you to do. And what's that mean? It means you're only valuable to me if I get something out of you. And that's not God. God can't expect to get anything out of us because he didn't need anything from us. God is independent of his creation. He didn't need us. We need him. And he knows that. So his love is freely given. It's not, I'll love you if you behave. It's, I love you. Now, let's see if we can get into this behavior stuff. So, the whole point is that God declares his love for those who are nothing in the sense that his value of others is not related to what they can do for him. That's what Paul is saying in verse 3. If you still think you can do something on your own, independently of God, that will qualify you in some way for the love of God, you're nuts. That's what he's saying in verse 3. It doesn't have to do with sense of absolute nothingness. We are something. God created us. We are something in his eyes. But not in this area of performance out of our own ability. That's where the whole problem goes. So, at issue in the context is the attitude of those who are going to be involved in trying to deal with somebody who's fallen into sin. And there are those who are spiritual that are going to be able to restore them, perhaps, if they can be restored. And what is a spiritual person? He's a person who understands that by the Spirit. The Spirit of God is the one who has to act if a transgressor is going to be restored. It's the Spirit of God. So spiritual people know that. Then there are, in this text, those who are not spiritual, but they think they're superior to the transgressor. And that they'll be able to restore this person by simply making themselves the illustration of how you ought to do stuff. That won't work. And then there are those who are not spiritual, but they know that not only are they not spiritual, they're out of their depth here. I don't know how to deal with this. That's not a bad place to be. But it does mean you're not going to be useful to God for restoring them, because you can't. He's not going to use this tool to do this job because it's not suited. That's why Paul says you are spiritual. He's assuming a certain level of maturity and competence that's been developed over time by the Spirit. And then there's the transgressor who has fallen, and he's not going to respond properly to those who are stark raving mad in their commitment to their own abilities. They're not. People come across to other people certain ways. And we pick this up. We automatically sense this. I have a friend in Louisiana. He's a good friend. I enjoy being around him. We have visited together. But he asked me yesterday or the day before, what do you do when you go to Georgetown? What is that? I said, well, it's kind of like a home church. I said, the folks over there have run into some static with trying to find a church that they can live with in terms of the churches preaching things that they can't live with. And his response was, well, I've pretty well decided that I could go to anybody's church and just listen to what God has to say to me and blow off the rest. And I thought, That is BS. But I didn't tell him. I mean, you know, we're friends, but I didn't want to just hit him in the face. No, you're nuts, man. Because all he was doing was trying to promote himself, make himself look more spiritual than you poor folks. Can't find a decent church because you're too stinking particular or whatever. You just don't know how to listen to God's voice. That's what he was telling me.
Yeah.
Well, it's just arrogance. I still like him. He's still a good friend, but he's just nuts when it comes to his own idea about himself because he thinks he's something and he's not.
Well, that does get to be an issue.
Oh, sure it does. It comes across really strong to the person who's caught.
Well, but I mean, like even for, I mean, I struggle with who I think I am.
Yeah.
Because I go to the church and it's, you know, they want to put up an $8 million youth mm-hmm. facility or put up a no vacancy sign.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, put up a sign, you know, or this. And so I feel like, well, that's just, I can't really bond with those people because I don't have that same philosophy.
That's true. Micah asked a long time ago, can two walk together except they be agreed? And for the last 100 years, people have been saying, yeah, yeah, they can get along if they don't agree. Disagree not to, you know, to disagree. No, it can't. You can't walk together if you're not agreed. Now, in Christian realm, you do have to make a decision between, well, okay, we're not ever going to agree about everything. I don't agree about everything with my wife. We've been together for over 40-something years now. Well, how'd you do that? Well, I ignored some of the stuff that I didn't agree with her on, and she ignored some of the stuff that she didn't agree with me on. Well, at what point can you ignore? Well, the Bible has these relative stages. Where does the Bible say that I will no longer tolerate Hazel? One thing, sexual impurity. That's the only thing. Otherwise, swallow it, man. She's got to do the same thing. So, when the Bible does that to us, tells us, okay, there's these grades of things that you tolerate and don't tolerate. When you go to a church, you have to say, okay, can I live with this or not? And if the answer is not, you hit the door.
Yeah.
And with no guilt, you just, no, can't agree here. But on the other hand, you have to ask, okay, what happens if I do go along with this even though I don't agree? Well, then you may find yourself caught in the same kind of situation that my son was caught in when the church begins to be have a lack of integrity, and you have to go along with it. I don't have to go along with it. I hit the door. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that you do have to deal with. But the fact is, Paul is actually saying here in this text that you have to be as clear as you can be about your own abilities or inabilities. That's what verse 3 is talking about. I can't accomplish a stinking thing in terms of significant or even insignificant real accomplishment. The Spirit of God has been given to me because of my total incapacity. So it is the Spirit of God who will produce any good thing that comes out of this body, the words that come out of this mouth. It'll be the Spirit of God or it won't be fruitful. And I'm comfortable with that. I don't mind that. I think that's great, because that's his promise. And if I just believe it, he'll allow me to be a worker with him in this process, but he's going to get the credit because it's him doing the work. And that's legit. So what's going on here is Paul is saying that you're nothing only in the realm of whether you see yourself as a dependent actor whose success in accomplishment in a relational universe depends entirely on the activities of the Spirit of God, or whether you think you can handle it on your own. That's the area. If you think you can handle it, you can't. You're crazy. That's what verse 3 is about. So the actual application in the text is, Paul's attempting to get there's got to be a few spiritual people in Galatia. He's trying to get them to hold toe the line. Hold the deal on spirituality, that you don't depend on yourself, you depend on God. Hold that, and the gospel will be anchored. Let it go, and the gospel will disappear. If you don't hold on to that point, then legalism will take over. So in the process, you just have to be consciously dependent on the Spirit constantly. God's promise is he'll accomplish what he wants to accomplish through us if we'll trust him, and in spite of us if we don't. His program is not dependent on us. It's dependent on Him. But He'll let us be co-workers together with Him if we want to be.